from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up, San Francisco Giants pitcher Jeremy Affelt joins us. His new book details his faith in Jesus Christ and how it's guided his life and career in Major League Baseball. He admits to overcoming what he calls his own sinful homophobia and describes how moving to San Francisco dramatically changed his life. Talk with him about his commitment to philanthropy and social justice and why he gave back $500,000 when the Giants accidentally added it to his contract. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. This hour, we're going to talk baseball, philanthropy, and social justice with San Francisco Giants relief pitcher Jeremy Affelt. Affelt joined the team in 2009, and it was a breakout season for him. Since then, he's been a mainstay of the Giants' bullpen. He played key roles in the team's run to the World Series wins in two of the last three seasons. And now he's written a book. It's titled To Stir a Movement, Life, Justice, and Major League Baseball. It describes how his religion and faith in Jesus Christ have guided him toward issues like human trafficking, hunger, and poverty. Jeremy Affelt, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Let me ask you, first of all, about the team. And last night, you guys came off of a dismal road trip to Toronto and Denver. Very much needed a win last night, and you got it. 8-0 over the Nationals, but it came at a real price. Your buddy, your pitcher Ryan Vogelsong, broke a finger in his right hand, his pitching hand. How's he doing?
Well, I think he's doing well. I talked to him after the game, and we knew he broke it. But a lot of times when you break something, you don't know the caliber of the break. Can you pitch with that break? Especially with a pitching hand, it's just a matter of what kind of break is it. And when he looked at me, he said, "I surgery tomorrow, or possible surgery tomorrow, or whatever." I was like, "Man, what?" And, you know, it was up. And then he showed me a picture of his X-ray, and it's just a devastating thing when you have to go through something like that, because he's one of your main five, and he's also a big part of this team. And to see something happen that's so random like that, it's really frustrating, and that's the price of a hitting pitcher at times.
Exactly, and it was kind of a freaky thing. He was at bat, and the irony is that he struggled all season long. He's got one of the highest ERAs in the league. And he had pitched five shutout innings, got up to bat, and swung and got hit with the pitch. Kind of a freak accident, really. Well, certainly the pitcher wasn't trying to hit him.
Yeah, no, it looked like it was a two-seamer inside, so he's just trying to run it in, keep it off the barrel, because you're trying to possibly get a double play ball right there. Just to, you know, there's some guys on base, so you're trying to keep the ball in the infield. And yeah, he just swung it with his hand. You saw it in slow-mo when it hit his hand. You knew at the velocity that guy was throwing, and then he actually swung at the ball, so he challenged the baseball, and hitting the hand there wasn't going to be good. But yeah, it was an outing where it looked like he was turning things around too. So what a frustrating deal for him a little bit, but maybe this will be the mental break he needs a little bit to kind of take a step back and gather himself, and when he comes back, he'll come back stronger.
And they're saying like 4 to 6 weeks, but some of the commentators last night were saying that's really optimistic.
Well, 4 to 6, you know, probably more on the 6 side, just because for one, he's a starter. So when you're hurt that long and you got to let it heal up and come back, well, then you have to get your pitch count back up. And that's the thing that kind of delays the start. If you're a reliever, 4 or 5 weeks, you go out there, if you can throw 20 pitches, you're good to go. And so this could take a little bit longer, but our guys are really good. Our surgeons are really good, and our trainers are some of the best I've ever seen at rehabbing guys. I've seen them a few times, so I know that. So I think everything will be fine.
Well, and speaking of freak accidents, you've got a little history with that yourself. Personally, not so much playing baseball, but with hamburgers,
yeah,
frozen hamburgers, and what else? You fell on a pier while you were fishing?
Yeah, ripped my lip off.
The whole lip came off.
Yeah, I just ripped it off. They had to sew it back on, and my oldest son jumped in my arms last year and blew out my kneecap when I was squatting. I mean, I've had the whole gamut. I think every body part has been hurt.
Blisters,
yeah, nail removal for the blisters.
You're being tested.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell us about your book and this journey that you describe in the book. You grew up, you were the son of an Air Force dad. You moved around a lot. You lived in Guam. You lived in Merced, California, Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I think you grew up and were born, rather, in Washington State. Is that right?
Arizona. Phoenix, yeah.
Okay. So what was that like as a kid, moving around like that?
Well, you had to make friends quickly, and they couldn't be solid friends. You had to make a lot of superficial relationships due to the fact that you knew you were going to leave in a couple years. You kind of made some friends on the Air Force base there where you were at, and then you just kind of left. And everybody knew the gig, even as a kid, you know, second, third, fourth grade, especially. I lived in Guam, and, I don't remember my best friend. I can remember his face. I can't remember his name. You know, type deal. And that's kind of
how old were you at that time?
I was probably, third, fourth grade is what, 8, 9, yeah. Probably 10-ish. I just remember he was a big boogie boarder, and I tried to learn how to do that with him, and we hung out a little bit and went to the same, went to a Christian school offsite, but went with them. But like I said, I can't remember his name for anything. I can't remember my teacher's names. I can't remember anything. It was just so much moving around for me.
What do you think that does to a kid, or what did it do to you?
Well, I think it helped to you understand how to be more outgoing, I think, because
you have to make friends quickly.
Yeah, and you had to just, hey, this is who I am. And you weren't shy. You just kind of were open about a lot of things. I got to see a lot early, but also I think that it can affect you in different ways. Even now, my wife told me, she goes, I'm actually kind of worried about when you retire because you can't stay in one spot. You've never been in one spot. I lived in Washington State since 93, but I've never lived there year round. I've always left for baseball so it's going to be tough.
And you've also traveled around as a player. You've been in Kansas City and Cincinnati and
Colorado.
Denver here. Yeah.
Yeah. And then minor leagues. I mean, every year you're in a new spot there and you're living three places a year. It's kind of been that way my whole life.
Does it make you, as a father, because you've got three young sons, does it make you want to not have your kids have that kind of childhood or not?
I think giving him experiential learning is huge. I do believe in that, but also stability is very big as well. And it is a concern of mine, moving around as much as we do. And my oldest son that, he's like, hey dad, when are we going to go to the Cactus House? Or when are we going to go to the, San Fran House? And that's, to me, is kind of weird. But that's his life and that's all he knows. And he calls our house back home. We have like an old wagon in the front yard as part of the landscaping deal. And he says, when are we going to go to the wagon house again? And to hear that, it's kind of funny, but then it's almost like that's a tough reality for a young man.
In two places.
Yeah. I don't know if I really want that for him long term.
So how does that work for schools? Cause you're here roughly April through hopefully November or October. Yeah. So where did they go to school then in two places?
Yeah. I put my son in my oldest was half day kindergarten last year, but I pulled him early. So I'm going to probably put him in kindergarten again. He's at the cutoff date and I don't mind putting him back in. He's going to go to full days. They actually have to leave early this year though. So I'm going to, and that's the tough thing for me is my family's going to leave in mid-August probably. And I'm going to be away from them and I'll try to see them on off days or come in on a road trip or something. And then you look around. My wife the other day just found a person that could tutor him. Like I found a person that can maybe tutor Walker a little bit this summer just to kind of get him caught up. And
he's the 5.5-year-old?
Yeah. He's 5.5. But he's a very smart kid, but for me, I don't know what kind of long-term effects it can happen, and hopefully I don't have to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, this book that you've written, To Stir a Movement, describes your early life, of course. And I want to ask you before I get into the social justice stuff. Seems like you were kind of an angry kid in some ways. I'll ask you about this in a moment, but an angry adult in moments of your career.
Yeah, I think as a baseball player in general, because I'm so competitive and athletic and I want to win and I want to do things in certain ways and I'm kind of disciplined that way, the control issue it has been a fight for me.
Control of your own emotions?
Yeah, control. Just controlling people, controlling
pitches.
pitches, controlling environments, controlling how things are in my home. And for me, marriage has been an interesting journey on the fact that you can't try to control your wife and kids, but that's been a kind of a tougher thing for me to adjust because you want things a certain way because as a kid growing up, you had to control your environment. And this, I was moving around a lot. I had to control who I did hang out with, who I didn't hang out with, or I did hang out with. And it was like I had to control my environment to make things normal.
Stable.
And, yeah. And so as a kid, you know, growing up as a high school kid, the lack of, you know, my dad was gone my freshman year. I was trying to make new friends. This time I was in high school. And so when you didn't, things were not going your way, I would get angry to hopefully cause people to hear me and so I could control the situation. And it just developed into a bad deal.
And you describe in the book when you were playing for Kansas City, you were angry. They were, I think, in New York City playing the Yankees, and there was a game. I think maybe you got taken out of the game or you were unhappy with the way the manager was playing you.
Mm-hmm.
And you threw a swing at him.
Yeah.
A punch at him. And then later you threw a chair at him.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that, again, it was control. It was a situation where the night before I had blown a save. And then in New York, and then I got put in a mop-up situation. I felt like I was getting punished. And so when I was pretty angry about the role that I was being put in right there. And then there was some things said that were not good and some things that were not true about me. So then when, as a competitive person, manager or not manager, you're in a competitive mindset. And when all of a sudden you get challenged, the control thing you can't talk. I'm going to challenge you back. And now you tow up. Now no longer it's not manager, player. It's man to man. And now there's a pretty harsh argument.
Clash.
And then he challenged me as a man. And so then bad things can happen. And I think it was just that environment of being addicted to the whole control and anger issue that I felt like I could bring the manager into seeing what I wanted to see by being angry and controlling him by my anger. And it was not a very friendly atmosphere in that clubhouse at the time.
Although the good news is you did become friends with Buddy Bell, the manager.
Yeah, the rest of the season we sat down, had a good talk, and he kind of asked me what I needed to find my stuff again because I was struggling a little bit. And I told him this is what I needed and help in the areas that I needed. And he got that for me. And honestly, I thought we had a pretty good relationship after that.
Yeah. You know, this just occurred to me yesterday as I was reading the book. And I was thinking, what if in that instance where you threw a punch at the manager and you threw a chair at him, if you were African-American, you think there would have been a different outcome for you?
I don't think so, because I think in baseball, really.
Or that, Latino. I mean, it's just race is the question, really. It's
yeah,
about race.
No, I don't think so. You know, I've seen a lot of things in the clubhouse that, you know, stay in the clubhouse a lot of times, a lot of anger issues and a lot of challenges. And I think, honestly, because we are such a close-knit family in that clubhouse, we don't see race. We really don't. Now, there is some language barriers at times because
Spanish.
Yeah, because you say something and they only hear a couple things that you said. And so they don't know the way in which you said it. And so sometimes they get upset. And a lot of times we have to bring another player in that
mediate.
Knows really good English to mediate.
But, who does that for the Giants?
You know, I think Scudero and Pagan are very, very good at it. I think they're very good at relating with American guys and the Latin guys because they've lived here a long time and they know really good English. You know, the coaches, Roberto Kelly, Bam Bam Mullins. Bam Bam knows 8 different languages or whatever. The guy can communicate to we have Japanese trainers and he can communicate to them just fine. And
yeah.
So, you know, we have guys that can do that. And like I said, we're a family. So the racing really doesn't play a role in this situation.
Talking with Jeremy Affelt, the relief pitcher for the Giants. He's got a new book out. It's called To Stir a Movement, Life, Justice, and Major League Baseball. Jeremy, I wonder if I could get you to read a little bit from the book. This is
sure.
The chapter that's titled Striking Out Injustice. And if you just read a bit from that, if you would.
Okay. Yeah, it's from the first part of the chapter about me kind of not having a lot of compassion in my life early on, until the last few years. So I'll start with the beginning. It said, I never thought about justice, poverty, or social issues when I was growing up. I once saw a homeless person and told him, get a job. You're lazy. Take a shower and cut off your beard. Go to McDonald's and be a janitor. Do something, man. I rolled my eyes and walked away. I didn't have a compassionate bone in my body. Not for the kid who was getting bullied, not for the orphan in Africa, not for anyone. I heard some talk about abortion growing up, but it was usually discussed in one-dimensional terms. Had it been addressed from a biblical perspective, we would have been talking about adopting unwanted babies and providing care for unwed mothers. Instead, we talked about abortion from the perspective of a conservative political agenda that created a lot of division. On one occasion, I went to a homeless shelter to help serve meals to the residents. I don't think I really even saw them as people, as human beings. I was too self-centered to really care. I thought the shelter was dirty and the residents smelled funny. I had no desire to talk to them or hang with them. I just wanted to leave.
Jeremy, I thought reading from To Stir a Movement. So the obvious question, what changed that?
You know, I think a lot of things changed it. I think my, you know, I was, yeah, obviously I have a view of God and I have, and spirituality is a huge part of my life. Growing up, it was big in other ways. Now it's big in obviously completely different ways now as I've matured. But
how is it different?
You know, growing up, I just trying to figure out why I was even here, my purpose, or who is God, or what is he supposed to be, or hey, God, hey, I need you to help me score 20 points in basketball, or why is
what can you do for me, God?
Yeah, or why is my girlfriend breaking up with me for no reason? Like, just ways at that time as a 16-year-old are huge issues. Now I see him as just a very compassionate, loving God, full of grace and mercy. And so when I see through those kind of eyes, now I look at the human being differently, because now I don't have as much of that selfishness of, instead of it's not about me. When I was younger, it was, no, it's all about me. So I don't have time for a homeless guy who I think is lazy, or I don't have, you know, now I look at a homeless person and I want to know their story. Because I believe Jesus said two things. He said, love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Against those two laws, there are no laws.
So what did something or someone flip a switch in you? When did it change? How did it change?
Well, it started in Kansas City a little bit. I was hanging out with a guy named Mike King. He runs a group called Youth Front out of Kansas City.
And nonprofit.
He is a nonprofit, but it's with youth. And he started talking to me about poverty issues, and we wanted to do a hunger initiative. And right at the time I was starting to learn about the Hunger Initiative, I was just starting to study a little bit. And this is actually, I got traded to Colorado, and it was kind of at the back end of Colorado and in Cincinnati time frame that I was reading the Matthew 25, least of these. And if you don't serve the least of these, you don't serve me. So if you don't see with those eyes, you do not see God. And so when I was starting to hang out with Mike King and he wanted to do a hunger initiative, at first it was a financial, I'll help you out financially. But then I got caught up in it, and it was just changed my whole world, because to see with eyes of compassion is really, really good. But to act on that compassion is called justice. And a lot of people have compassion and they don't do anything about it. That's not going to help.
Is justice free from judgment?
I believe it is, because when I look at somebody now, I don't have the whole judgmental feeling of, you know, change your life, figure it out. It's more of like, let me know the story of your life. And
how did
why
you get to where you are?
Right. And if it is from laziness or it is from lack of discipline, then let's help in those areas, not condemn, not judge, not, because pushing somebody down will not allow them to raise up. And I think that is the concept of a human being, is to figure out where people are in trouble and help them raise up.
And you write in the book, then I can't remember the time frame. I think it was before you got to the Giants, but that you realized that you were judging all of your teammates.
Yeah, it was actually while I was playing. It was during the 2010 World Series year. I was really frustrated with how things were going in that year. I just won the setup man of the year in 2009. 2010, all of a sudden, I'm not setting up for. I was never.
What does
told.
That mean?
I was the best. They gave me the best reliever that gets the ball from the starter to the closer with a lead. So the setup man right in there is the 7th, 8th inning. And they gave me setup man of the year in all of baseball. That was American.
You had like a 1.73 ERA that year.
Yeah, that was not a normal year, obviously, for any pitcher, really. But, you know, I think that – and then so I was really angry. I was judging Bochy. I was like, why is he doing this? I was talking about this. They're against me. Why are they trying to hold me back? I just signed an extension, so why would you extend me and then not pitch me? And then certain players weren't playing very good behind me. And my father-in-law came up to me and said, you know, you continue to judge these guys, they will actually never fail you, because you're always judging them. And so when they mess up, you'll continue to judge them. You will not turn away. How you look at people sometimes is how you're going to – your pattern for life. If you continue to think negatively, negative things are going to happen.
And do you think they could tell you were judging them? I mean, did it change when you made that realization and started thinking differently? Did it change your relationships with them, not just inside of you but between the two of you?
Yeah, I don't know if they could tell, but now when I went to the clubhouse, I didn't look around and wasn't angry at my situation, because a lot of times when we're judging people, it's because your situation is bad. So you want to figure out had to make everybody else at fault.
Drag them down too.
Right. And so I think just I started enjoying my teammates. I started enjoying my manager. I started coming to the field early and praying for Bochy to make quality decisions that would help us win. Not about when is he going to pitch me or why am I not pitching. It's help. You know, I was praying for my teammates and their families. And all of a sudden I found that I was actually treating them as a human being, not as a, you know what, just get my ground ball.
Yeah.
Or just make sure you catch the ball, or make sure you score when you're supposed to. And it was more like, you know what, I care about you as a person. And when I started doing that, I was judging them less. And when I judged them less, I saw them for who they really were. And that was a human being.
And you write in the book that you do pray when you're on the mound. Did that experience you just described, did it change what you prayed about?
No, I think I've always prayed for wisdom. I've always prayed for just, you know, when we pitch in these competitive ball games, the more you relax, the better your stuff's going to be, because the quicker your arm, your release point, your focus is going to be better. And when you pitch tight, everything gets tight. So your arm gets tight, your release point's off, you doubt yourself at the delivery of the pitch, which causes a lot of bad issues. So for me, I don't pray that, you know, oh, God, please tell me what this guy's thinking so I can throw the opposite. I don't pray that. I just pray for relaxation. I ask that I would just have that perfect peace that I believe God, only God can give you when I'm out there. And then I just relax and make my pitches and let it be what it is. And I believe he's got control of the situation.
Yeah. One of the things you wrote in the book is that before you came to San Francisco, that you had what you described as sinful homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you would come to town with the other teams, I think maybe it was Colorado, that you wouldn't leave your hotel room. What were you afraid of? And what was behind the homophobia? What made you realize that?
You know, honestly, to if someone were to say, what are you afraid of? I really have no idea what I was afraid of. Other than the fact that I came from a very conservative background, in the sense that every military bases are the don't ask, don't tell policies. And so you don't see a lot of the homosexual community on military bases, which I was raised up in. And military bases aren't exactly the most tender places. These military, they're tough guys, man. They're focused, they're driven. They have, I mean, it is a really tough, you know, mentality type.
And it has to be in some ways.
It has to be. You're fighting for a living, and you're possibly taking lives. I mean, but then I grew up in Spokane, Washington, when we didn't live on the military base. That's a very conservative area. You don't see a lot of those things going on. And the racial thing is there, obviously, with the white supremacist groups over there in Idaho, but you don't really have a lot of hate crimes happening there. And so I didn't see a lot of those things where I could. And so when you come to San Fran and you see the outgoingness of it, you feel awkward. And so you don't, and you're like, I don't know if I want to be out in this situation, because you kind of almost get angry, because you're like, you almost maybe you're gross or this or that. You have these random feelings because you're just, you have not really taken the chance to step back and learn their story. Hmm. And that's what I started doing.
And how did you do that?
You know, in Cincinnati, I would go to Starbucks every morning. It was just down the road from our place there. A lot of times at that time, I just had one son. I'd take Walker with me and give Mama a break a little bit. And we'd go sit at Starbucks and play games. And there was a gay barista there. And the way he talked with Walker and just played and full of joy, and I started just saying, man, this guy's a really happy guy, man. Like, but I didn't, at first you're like, I don't know if I want to go to Starbucks today, if that guy's there. But then you take a step back and you're like, why? And I really felt God say, why?
You challenged yourself, and maybe God challenged you as well.
And it was a great experience. And I really, and the way he treated my son, and the way my son laughed and giggled. I mean, he was a good human being.
Yeah.
And so why be angry?
Yeah. Jeremy Affeldt, his new book is called To Stir a Movement, Life, Justice, and Major League Baseball. And we're going to talk with him for the rest of this hour, and I'm sure you would like to talk with him as well. The number to call, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can also shoot us an email, forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. In today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny and my guest, Jeremy Affeldt, the Giants' left-handed relief pitcher who is here, got an appearance last night. Must feel good to go into a game when you're ninth inning, you're up 8-0.
Yeah, you got to kind of stay focused a little bit more in those situations, though. Obviously, you have a good chance of winning, but two, you don't want to try to just get lazy up there and then just kind of flippantly throw stuff up there. You got to remember there's major league hitters in there that want to get back. They've been kind of getting beat up a little bit that game, and they want to get back at somebody for it. So you just you try to stay focused.
Well, it was three up, three down, so you did just fine. And by the way, Jeremy's new book is called To Stir a Movement, Life Justice and Major League Baseball. He's going to be at the Giants Dugout Store today at 18. Park from 1 to 2 signing copies. So if you want to see him in person, you can do that. 866-733-6786, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Let's go right to the phones now. John is on the line in Alameda. Welcome.
Good morning. I've been an Episcopalian all my life, Jeremy, and I really appreciate what you do on the mound, but I'm curious to know a couple of things. Where do you go to church now? Where have you found a community that matches where you are now compared to where you were, say, 20 years ago? And what kind of community is that for you? How does it work? And how do you handle things like going to church when you're on the road, going all over the country?
Yeah, those are good questions. You know, because of baseball, you know, we play on Sundays, and a lot of times are day games, and there's no way that there's a service that starts at 5 a.m. that I can get to, nor do I want to be up at 5 a.m. trying to get there and then playing a game. So, you know, a lot of the church services I do, we have a chapel during the season at the ballpark. They have one for the players, and they also have one for their wives. And then we also have opportunities. When I'm on the road, there's a couple groups that I really try to key in on. And one of them is Bethel up in Reading. And they have an actual app on their phone. And I can actually tap in and when I'm in the hotel rooms on Wi-Fi. And I can actually watch previous messages or a live message if it's going at the time. And I read a lot of books. And so church is different for me in the season. In the off season, I go to a community, a place called Victory Faith. And for me, it's just a community of people that I love worship. So it's very, very big for me to worship and to have some good worship. But my ability to go to church on Sundays is not there. So if you have I have to go to church twice on Sundays and on Wednesdays at the same time during the week, that's not really the life I'm going to be able to live.
John, does that respond to your question?
Yeah, he sure did.
All right, thanks. Hey. Thanks so much. How does religion work in the clubhouse? Or I imagine a lot of guys I know come from South Central America. Mm-hmm. A lot of Catholic players, I imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, how does Ryan Vogelsong? I know is quite spiritual as well. So how does that work in the clubhouse? At least with the Giants.
Well, it's a lead by example. I think, St. Francis of Assisi said, you live the gospel always, and when necessary, use words. And I think that is a huge deal for me, because I think you have to lead by example. If you sit there and continue to force the Bible down someone's throat in a baseball team, one, they do not like you for that. That is going to be really, really rejected. Two, it almost annoys guys because it's like, hey, look, if I'm ready or if I'm willing, I know who you are. I'll come to you. And that's really, I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with talking with guys. And when they ask me my opinion, I say, do you want my opinion? Yes, I want your opinion. Okay, here's my opinion. And here's how I get it from a biblical perspective. But I'm not going to just offer my opinion spiritually to guys that they don't ask for it because it's a turnoff. So I try to lead by example as much as I can. And when they ask for my opinion, I use words.
Yeah. And is remember last year, especially during the playoffs and the World Series, I mean, Hunter Spence stood up and really Hunter Pence became a real spiritual leader for the team, or at least it seemed that way from the outside. What was going on there, and what kind of spiritual leadership was that, and how does it compare to what you're describing?
Well, his was more like of a
pep talk.
Yeah, pep talk type stuff. And I'm not a huge guy on that. I think that, I try to like limit my emotions. I try to become like calm. But guys loved it, and he looked at me, and because Buster's the same way I am. I try to be as calm. He's obviously a very calm player.
Yeah.
And so when he starts doing the rah-rah stuff and the chant and the seeds start flying everywhere and we start doing the dog pyre and dancing back and forth, that is a football-type scenario, I think, when it comes to rah-rah. And so he looked at me and Buster after the Cincinnati series when we won. He goes, I know you guys aren't really big into that, but I felt like, it needed to be done. And I said, Hunter, it has nothing to do with whether I'm into it or not. I'm trying to relax myself because I'm going to pitch in a situation where I cannot be overly pumped up because I don't need firing balls off the backstop and jumping around out there. But did you do what needed to be done to rally the troops? You did. And there are guys on the team, most of them, that are very, very, very enthused to do those kind of things. Continue to do it whenever you want. I might not get overly excited like some guys, but it is what is needed for the majority of our guys. So don't think that I'm against it. I'm for it. I just don't react the same way.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. Good. Well, it worked.
Yeah, it did. Definitely did.
And they got a good commercial out of it, too.
Yeah, they did.
That was a lot of fun. All right, back to the phones. Aaron in San Francisco, welcome.
Oh, hi. Well, that was a really cool story right there. I wanted to echo some of Jeremy's thoughts earlier about control. That really touched a note with me. I grew up playing basketball all the way through college. I'm 40 now. You know, I've been playing recreationally that and some other stuff, you know, for almost 20 years since. And only in the last few years with, you know, some help from other folks did I really start to see how much, throughout all phases of my life as a parent, friend, a husband, et cetera, how much really trying to control and dictate outcomes that was a part of my personality. And I kind of suspect that, you know, for me, it was largely sports. I feel like I've observed folks who come from other maybe highly competitive environments that you see a lot of in, you know, in kind of big city life, business, academics, et cetera, you know, where it's all about goals and drive. I think we're very susceptible to falling into being so focused on our goals that we tend to put people and experiences and anything that we come across into the buckets of either something that's helping us toward our goal or something or someone that's impeding our progress toward our goal. And that kind of, and I just think it's wonderful that somebody with a, you know, a bit of a platform is able to so clearly articulate his experience of kind of breaking through that self-absorption and being able to take himself out of the middle of things and see bigger issues and work towards more important goals.
Well, and Jeremy, with your philanthropic work, you focused on things that are really, you know, have, you know, nothing to do with your own life personally, really. Human trafficking, hunger, clean water, orphanages, homeless kids, those kinds of things.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, what happens is when you have control issues, you become very, it's a selfish mentality. And we all have it to a point. But I think when you key in on loving your neighbor as yourself and loving the least of these, you take it, you get out of your selfishness. Even when you love your neighbor as yourself, you have to first know how to love yourself, but then you have to look at saying, well, if I'm hungry, well, I eat. If I'm thirsty, I go get something to drink. If I'm probably not going to volunteer to live in a tree fort in the middle of winter with no roof over my head. I want to live in a home that's warm. And so when you look at those things and you have opportunities to serve those things, you do it. And now you're selfless. Now you're like, okay, how can I use my platform and the means that I have to help other people? Because once you help other people dream, and that is obviously giving them the basics, food, water, clothing, shelter, they now can be free to do things and to dream big. And same with trafficking. No one's, I obviously I get paid and I know I'm hired to do my job, but I am not getting forced to do something I don't want to do for nothing. And so I won't allow anybody to enslave me into anything. And so I don't want to see people put in slavery, especially in some of the adult situations they're put in. And I'm willing to use my platform to free these people because I believe that I was given so many opportunities to accomplish my dreams into what I was destined to become as an athlete that I want to give opportunities for other people. And so if I can think that way, I become a very selfless person and I control less.
Yeah, Aaron, thanks very much for the call. When you told the Giants, and I assume you told the Giants, that you were writing a book and that it was about your faith and spirituality and justice, did they get nervous at all? I mean, did they say, can we see the book before it comes out? What's it about? Are you going to say, you're going to write something that's going to get us in trouble or put us on the front page?
No, I think that one of the things I have is a very good relationship with the front office. And this book obviously was 2 years in the making, but it was also ended up being 3-4 years of relationship with the Giants. And they know me. They know who I am. They know how I think. And I don't think they were – I mentioned that I was writing a book or I was having some thoughts put down or there was a book coming out. They never ever one time questioned it. Now, I gave the book for them to read. And so some of that,
after it was published.
Yeah, my assistant GM, Bobby Evans, has read it, and there is some, and they actually put it in their own dugout stores. So for me, it was a deal where it's like, I told them, I said, you know, there are some spirituality stuff in there, just to let you know if you're going to put it in your stores. And their comment to me was very good. They're like, well, one, we're not necessarily saying we're backing everything you're saying, but we also are believing and trusting in the relationship you have. You're not going to say anything that's going to cause a lot of problems either. And so for me, the relationship's so good, I didn't worry about any of that stuff. I don't think they did either.
Here's a listener comment. This guy is so open about his experiences and feelings, especially about control issues, really refreshing. Another reason to like the varied crew that comprise the Giants. Ken from Livermore writes, not being devout in the religious sense, but being a devout A's fan and detesting the Giants, smiley face, how much credit do you give to divine intervention in the Giants' last World Series win? It's great hearing a ballplayer speak of important things in life. Keep up the good work.
With the divine intervention, you know, I think someone asked me that. They said, does God care about baseball? Well, my answer is yes. I mean, that's like saying, does God care about a business, or does God care about, you know, if this is my job, and I'm a servant, I believe, of the Almighty God. So for me, to say he does not care about baseball, I think is wrong. He gifted me to do these things. One, and he created the minds of the guys that Abner Doubleday, he created that guy's mind. And if you think about baseball, 60 feet, 6 inches, if I were to throw any further than that, my arm would fall off. Mm. If I were to throw any closer than that, the hitter would have no chance. Mm. 90 feet to the bases, when our shortstop throws the ball, I mean, it is a bang, bang play. I mean, these. So to me, I think he created distances that are right. I mean, if you think about the physics of a baseball and how it travels, and I think there is a creator to it. But now, wins and losses, I don't know. I think that he
doesn't get involved in the details.
Yeah, I think he gives you a talent, and he says, if you execute the way that you should execute, you will have a success. You will be a success as a hitter, pitcher, whatever. It's not like I stand a guy in the box, and I've had that before. Like, this guy's a Christian. I wonder if he prayed more than me today, you know, type thing. It's, you know what? There are places, if I throw a ball and execute my pitch, I can get him out. If I don't execute that pitch, he's given him the talent to hit that ball a long way. That's what it is. And so I think it's who executes better that wins games. I don't necessarily know if he cares about that, but he does care about baseball.
Yeah. You write in the book, it seems many Christians are filled more with fear and fight than with the radical love of our Savior, Jesus Christ. What did you mean by that?
I think it has a lot to do with if you look at where we key in on certain issues and where some of our people, in my opinion, if you read about Jesus, sinners, which are, that's what they say in the Bible, but I think it's just classified, people that do not live in the faith, loved Jesus, loved him. They hung out with him all the time. If I look at now, in my opinion, of the church or as a whole, not as an individual
building. When you say the church, what do you mean?
As a group of people, a body of believers in Jesus Christ, not as a church building, somewhat to do with the church building, but most of the time as a whole, if you talk to a person that does not share your faith, they will get very angry if you tell them you're a Christian, or they will get very angry if you try to give up a biblical concept. They do not like you because we judge. We're hypocritical, people will say. You're hypocritical. You'll say, oh, this person's not very good, but then you sin too. So for my thing is, it's a fear-based deal. The people that are like, oh, you guys are, you know, the TV evangelists, they just want money. I can see why they think that, because there's a lot of people that have stole money from people because they try to sit there and say, you got to give to me. It's a fear. Pastors, they're like, you're just afraid you're going to lose your tithers to give you your money if you don't, you know, act a certain way. Or the homosexual community, you're afraid that you're going to be able to hang out, and you're afraid that, you know what, they're not going to believe morally like you, or they're not going to do this, and then, you know, someone's going to judge you if you hang with them. What is my people in my church going to say if they see me hanging out with a homosexual? Your fear of man is getting higher than your fear in the sense of God, in the sense of reverential fear, respect of who God is. He created all man in the image of him. And if we look at people like that, you will not fear what people think of you. And I think that if we can get past this fear of what people think of us, we'll just learn to love our neighbor as ourselves. That is the concept of why Jesus said, my follower, you people will know you're my disciples if you what? Love one another. Not love one another in only if they agree with you. No, love one another. Preach that, live that. They will see me. You preach anything else, They won't see me and they'll hate you.
Somewhat related to that, we talked about, you just alluded to the gay thing, and Jason Collins came out recently, NBA player. How do you think an openly gay player would be received by the Giants today?
By the Giants or just in Major League Baseball in general?
The Giants.
I don't think there's going to be I think there'll be a fine reception here. I think if you look at what the Giants have done in the community, they have a lot of respect, in that area. We do the LGBT stuff. We do the anti-bullying campaigns.
Trevor Project.
We do.
It gets better.
Yeah, video. It gets better video. We do a lot of that. And when I first came to the Giants, I don't want to name her name because I have not asked permission. She's not longer there anymore, but she was on staff. She was a gay person on staff, and she didn't actually want to do anything with me in the public. She said not. She was a PR person, and I looked at her head PR lady, and I said, "Why doesn't she want it?" She goes, "Well, she knows you're a Christian. And she's, obviously has a preconceived notion of who you are."
Yeah, the judgment goes both ways.
Yeah, it does go both ways. But I said, "Put her on everything. She doesn't want to do anything with you. Are you her boss or not?" "Yeah." "I want to go do things with her. I want to go to the signings with her. I want to do, when I go visit groups, I want her to be there as a representation of the team. Allow me to have a relationship here." And, when she left, she had to go east. I went to her going away and she came up to me and said, "Jeremy, I just want to let you know, I'm really, thank you for being so kind to me." And I said, "Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be kind to you, because we don't have the opportunities because we have this barrier between the Christian community and the gay community that are not good, and they develop walls. And I don't understand how you can share the love of Jesus if you put up this wall of hate." So, and it goes both ways, but I'm tired of seeing the Christians protest God hates gays. And what is that going to do? Is that going to help the situation? I don't see one gay person say, "Oh, you know what? Thanks for that sign. I'm going to stop doing that now." That's not going to happen.
Yeah. A lot of gay fans at the park too. Definitely a lot of Giants and 49er fans. Let's go back to the phones. Neil is on the line, and I think, Neil, you may have gotten an answer in that last conversation right there, but go ahead.
Sort of. I have a question anyway. You said you read a lot on the road. What do you read?
Oh, the Katie Couric question.
I read a lot of different things. There are things that I read. Timothy Keller is one of the smartest and most intelligent spiritual leaders of today. He writes a few good books. I've been reading right now. I've been reading a lot on grace because I've been dealing with control stuff and learning how to have more grace in my family with my kids and my wife. So I've been doing a lot of grace-based stuff with how to raise your family. I've been doing a lot of grace-based stuff on how to handle other people. So I think for right now, I've been doing a lot of that. I don't read a lot of story type stuff. I tried to get into Hunger Games, and after about three chapters, that's exciting, but I got other books I need to read. They're more important, but I read a lot of those type of books.
Yeah. Neil, does that answer your question?
Sort of. Who is Keller?
Timothy Keller is a writer and also a pastor in New York. And he has a C.S. Lewis type style of writing. He will basically, he wrote a book, probably one of my favorite books of all time, called The Reason for God, and he proves God without the Bible, which I think is very, very big for a lot of people, that when you try to say, how do you know God exists, and you try to give Bible verses, and they say, "Well, I don't believe in the Bible, so prove it without that." He does a very good job of doing that, and so I enjoy reading his stuff.
All right, Neil, thanks very much for the call. 866-733-6786. If you want to talk with Jeremy Affeldt, 866-733-6786. Here's an email from Marilyn, who writes, "My son, who's 9, has your autograph on a ball and his glove. Listening to you today, I have to say, I'm glad he does. I'm not affiliated with any church, but to practice kindness, generosity, and spirituality daily and teach that to my sons. I often feel very annoyed, am I judging, with many of today's Christians. Thank you for being such a true Christian, and I look forward to reading your book with my son." And then Chris writes, "Congrats on the book. I appreciate the decency and honesty here, but being a non-religious person, it sounds like he is crediting his Christian faith for making him change some of his negative traits that came from his Christian faith." Is he misreading that?
I don't necessarily think so. I think
maybe
that,
the judgment or something.
Yeah, I am not actually. I wouldn't fight that thought. I think that it is natural to, you know, for us, when you're raised in a church background and you're raised to live a certain way, we naturally, just as human beings, want to make ourselves feel better. So you're going to sit there and say, well, okay, I know I'm supposed to do these things. And when you're not doing something right and someone does something wrong, you say, well, I don't do that. So I'm not as bad as him. So I'm better. So that means I'm a Christian. So I'm better. And I think that holier than thou mentality is what's causing a lot of problems with people in the church and people outside of the church.
Sort of shaming other people or pointing the finger.
Right. There's which is actually anti-Jesus.
Too. Yeah.
And if you truly read the words in red, I call them the words in red in the Bible. They're the words of Jesus. He's actually against those things. The Pharisaical stuff that people did, which I think they do a lot now in the church communities, were frowned upon by Jesus. So why do we do them? Get back. Simply fear. We're just afraid. We're just afraid of what people are thinking. We're afraid of becoming like them, or we're afraid of maybe we'll backslide. And I think if you're truly loved and saved by Jesus and the Holy Spirit's inside of you, you live a different way. In Romans, it points that out. Paul points that out. If you live by the Spirit, if you're saved by the Spirit, you live by the Spirit. If you're saved by the flesh, you live by the flesh.
And that's a belief that you share with your wife, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You are listening to Forum. We're talking with Jeremy Affeldt, his new book, of course, the Giants relief pitcher. And his new book is called To Stir a Movement, Life, Justice, and Major League Baseball. He's going to be at the Giants dugout store at AT&T Park today from 1 to 2 if you want to get a book and say hi. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. So what kind of reaction have you had to the book, Jeremy? Have any of your teammates read it?
You know, I've given it to a few of them, and I think some of them have read it. Yeah, the thing with teammates is even if they like the book, it's really hard for them to come up to you and be like, hey, man.
Why is that?
Then they got to call me cool. Author. They got to say, hey, author. You know, and they don't want to say.
Dr. Affeldt.
Yeah, they don't want to say you're a good you wrote a good story. You know, it's awkward, you know. Mm-hmm. But some of the guys that have read it, obviously Mike Sweeney, who's on the front of the cover, is a longtime teammate of mine. But I've sent it to a lot of different people and gotten their opinions. And people that have written books, Ortberg out of just south of here, Menlo Park. And then Scott McKnight, who's one of my favorite writers as well. Both said it's a well-written book. It's not deep, like in the sense of like theologically, like, man, but he says by the time you start and end the story, you learn – there's some concepts of learning there. And it wasn't meant to be deep. It was for 15 to 25-year-old males originally. Well, a 15-year-old male is more into the magazine in the picture than he is into the word. So,
or the video.
Yeah, so it was meant to be a little bit like an easy read.
Yeah,
And I feel like that's what it is, but there are some good concepts in there.
Here's an email from Charles. Trick question, perhaps. What is your perspective on the several passages of the New Testament that suggest giving away all your possessions?
Yeah, you know what? That's a really good thing. You know, I've learned a lot about grace and just understanding law. And here's where that comes from. That comes from a rich young ruler that says, Jesus, I've obeyed all of the commandments, the Ten Commandments, because Jesus is basically trying to say, if you try to obey the law, you'll fail every time. The law was put into play. The Ten Commandments were put into play not to obey. And people in the church can be like, wait a minute, what are you saying on the radio? You can't fulfill any of that. You cannot do it. Jesus said, I've not come to destroy it. I came to fulfill the law because you cannot do it. So my death on the cross is going to allow you to live in grace now, not by the law. You don't have to make sacrifices. This is I'm going to become the sacrifice now. Fulfill the law. Die for your sins, because if I don't, you will fail constantly. So a rich young man comes and says, hey, I've obeyed every single one of those laws since I was a kid. And Jesus goes, really? Yeah, every one of them. So now what do I have to do to get into heaven if you say it's not about the law? Jesus says, go sell everything you have. And the rich young ruler goes, I can't really do that. Okay, well. Yeah. And the whole point was that is the first law. You shall have no other gods before me. And so Jesus says, you fulfilled every law. Yeah, right. Go sell everything you have then. He couldn't do it. And it was not for all Christians who are wealthy to sell everything. It was to point out to the rich young ruler that you cannot possibly fulfill everything, because if you can't sell everything you have and follow me, you broke rule number one.
Yeah.
Not fulfilled. You haven't even got past the first rule yet.
Okay.
And so that whole concept was to put into play, like, you can't do it. And so for me, it's an eye-opening thing, but I don't think it has everything to do with selling everything you have.
You didn't give away everything, but you did give back $500,000. As you write in the book, there was a little clerical error that gave you $4.5 instead of $4 million in a contract, and you gave it back. Was that a tough call at all? I mean, how long did you have to think about that?
It wasn't that tough of a call from the—
You had some options, though.
Yeah. There was plenty of options, because the reality of it was, when the contract was negotiated and passed by the union and Major League Baseball, it's set in stone. I don't have to do anything. The team can't come to me and say, we made an error, you need the money back. No, by law, I don't have to give anything back to you. Legally, it was a binding contract. But, you know, from the integrity standpoint of things, when my agent caught it, and then actually my assistant GM caught it almost at the same time my agent did, after it was put through the process, they both said, you know, legally, you don't have to give this money back. So they're both very honest about that. And my agent said, Jeremy, as your agent, I'm telling you, you don't have to give the money back. I said, Mike, you've been my agent, but you've been my friend for 12 years. You know my family. I trust you with my family, obviously, because I let you negotiate. I don't step in on the negotiations. What are you telling me? He says, Jeremy, as a man, I'm saying you give the money back. And that's why I have my agent.
Yeah.
But I said, okay. And so I thought about it, and I was like, so time out. There's no, like, thank you gift here, like, for doing this.
Purchase.
I'm just trying to figure out and make sure. He's like, no, we never even talked about 2010. There's no way that's possible. And so for me, it was an integral decision. And I just said, I can't send that money back. But you could have done a lot of good with that money, Jeremy.
You could have, yeah, you could have given to a charity that both you
right.
and the Giants agreed to.
But if I look at life like I do through the eyes that I believe God allows me to look through life as, no good is going to— – I don't care what good the world thinks you did with it. It is not good before the eyes of God. It is dirty money. You have not— – that is – it's almost like God— – I don't even know if God would look on it as good. So for me, it's the only good that could come out of this here is not if I gave it away. Not— – it is giving it back.
What did your teammates say?
They didn't know. And I never let them know about it. And now it's out, obviously, now. But I knew when it would— – if it was going to come out, it was going to come out years after it happened. So it didn't look like a— – you know, I'm going to give this money back and then announce it to everybody. You know, yeah. I didn't want that because that's not the heart in which I did it. Mm-hmm. And so I think some of them were like, even I've had players come up to me just in Colorado. Helton came up to me and he was like, I played with him in Colorado and we're pretty good friends. And he said, I just read something that you could owe money or you gave some money back that you owed. What would happen there? And we have the same agent.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, I'm sure it's a good karma points, if nothing else. Jeremy Affeldt, to stir a movement, life, justice, and Major League Baseball. He's going to be at the AT&T Dugout Store today. Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for all your great work on the mound and off.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with support from David Marks. Our online editor, or senior editor, Dan Zoll, executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.